So we finished up at Judges chapter 20, verse 28 last week. So we'll pick up at verse 29 tonight. Judges chapter 20, verse 29. We're in the middle of a very messy war. And this all started with that whole twisted tale of the Levite from Ephraim and his concubine. He never should have had a concubine in the first place, but such were the times, and he did, and she was unfaithful to him, and she left him for a while. She went back home with dad there in Bethlehem of Judah, the birthplace of Christ, of course. And after 4 months or so, typical guy, after, you know, maybe 3 or 4 months, he says, oh, you know what? Where's she been? I just now noticed she's gone. Okay, that's probably not true. But after 4 months, he decides he's got to go to her father's house, or his father-in-law's house in Bethlehem, and win his concubine wife, his sex wife, back. And so he travels to Bethlehem to visit his father-in-law to see his quote-unquote wife. And he ends up staying there for a few days. His father-in-law is very clearly hoping that they patch things up, and I think a lot of that was stall tactic to try to give them time to talk. And after a handful of days, it would seem, at least by my reading of it, that the first couple times he tries to leave, he's going alone, just him and his servant. But then that last time, it says, you know, him and his wife, his concubine, are getting ready to go. And the father-in-law tries to talk him out of it. Tells him it's too late in the day to travel. Well, yes, but he's been pulling that for like a whole week. Every time he goes to leave, for whatever reason, it's just not a good time for him to go. Just stay another night. And he finally did leave, and his father-in-law was right. There wasn't enough time to make the journey all the way back home, so they find themselves getting close to dark and in need of a place to overnight. His servant suggests the nearest location, which would have been Jerusalem, but Jerusalem was inhabited by heathen Jebusites. And the Levite did not think that would be a safe place to overnight. I think he'd do that over again. Hindsight is 20/20. He felt like, hey, if we pick one of these nearby Jewish towns, just 5 miles away or 10 miles away, then we're going to be safer. And that would seem to be true. But, of course, that wasn't the case, because the place they picked, the nearest town about 5 miles away, was Gibeah. And that night, the men of Gibeah came beating down the door where the Levite was staying, and they wanted to have homosexual relations with him. And they offered up the Levite's concubine in his place. And you know the sordid story. She was raped and abused all night long. She ends up stretching out over the threshold at the door. It would appear she made it just to the door, but she dies there. And by morning she's dead. He wakes up to find her dead. And then he takes the body of his concubine back with him, chops the body up into 12 pieces, and then sends those 12 pieces out to the 12 tribes of Israel. They each got a piece, and this was to make a statement that it is time for change in Israel. Build Back Better did not work in Israel. What they needed was make Israel godly again. They needed a MIGA campaign. And so 11 of the 12 tribes were on board with that. It's time to get back to godliness. We can't be doing these wicked things. It's time for us to get back to godliness and punish the wicked, even as the law of Moses had commanded. So those 11 tribes unified over that. They came together. And unfortunately, Benjamin, the 12th of the 12, had decided that it would defend Gibeah, all for the very honorable reason of the fact that Gibeah was theirs. Gibeah belonged to them. Gibeah was a smaller clan within the larger tribe of Benjamin. So they stuck with the familial ties there. They defended Gibeah, even though it was a pretty wicked thing that they were defending, and that brought about all-out war between the 11 unified tribes, referred to from here on out as Israel in the text, and that one tribe of Benjamin. 400,000 soldiers from the unified 11 and 26,700 soldiers for Gibeah, and then Benjamin, the whole tribe of Benjamin, defending Gibeah. Pretty lopsided battle, but as weird as it was, those first two battles, those measly 26,700 soldiers killed 40,000. 40,000 soldiers from the 400,000, from the 11 tribes. And that brought us to verse 26, where the 11 tribes finally understood, okay, something's up here. Something is going on. This should not be happening. Benjamin, a little tribe in comparison to 11 tribes, they should not be whopping us and whooping us like they are. Something has got to be up here. And it was then that they had finally returned to the Lord and did the sensible thing, and we had here sort of a national returning to the Lord. They had made the decision, let's get back to the Lord, and let's ask the Lord to help us with this fight. Let's get the Lord in the war that we're in. Pretty much the only sensible thing that you'll read from anyone in these final four chapters of the book, or at least one of the very few. But problem for Israel, before that repentance, and you know, they tried this twice and lost, and the problem was that the 11 tribes were fighting against God's definition of wickedness when they weren't really even following the Lord for themselves. So that's hypocrisy. Like, what should it matter what the people of Gibeah did if the rest of the nation isn't following the Lord's? They're not the Lord's. If they're not following God's commands, well, then why would you go out to war to force other people to follow God's commands? So that was hypocrisy, and we talked about that last week, that if you're going to be zealous for others to follow the Lord's commands, well, you first have to be zealous for yourself, to follow the Lord's commands for yourself. So we read here in verse 26, this is already covered ground, but just to get us, kind of throw us back into the story here, that all the people of Israel, the whole army went up and came to Bethel, and that was where the tabernacle was located at the time. They went to Bethel and wept. They sat there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening and offered up burnt offerings to show a desire to be consecrated to God again, and peace offerings to show their desire to have fellowship with the Lord. 27, and the people of Israel inquired of the Lord. They sought the Lord. Verse 28, shall we go out once more to battle against our brothers, the people of Benjamin, or shall we cease? And the Lord said, go up, for tomorrow I will give them into your hand. And so we covered all of that last week. This was not the Lord setting them up to fail. He was just honoring their boundaries. The Lord did not have their hearts and their lives, so there was only so much that he would do for them. It was part of their covenant agreement, and this would be like a violation of their covenant agreement if they weren't really his people, but he was fighting their battles for them. And the Lord wasn't going to do that. He had already made that clear in the covenant, but God was gracious enough to give them the correct direction on whether or not they should go to battle. The Lord truly did, I believe, give them the right direction. They should have done that. And personally, I believe that had that situation perpetuated, had they continued on in that war against Benjamin and Gibeah without the Lord, I do think they would have eventually won, but at the cost of many soldiers lost. Because God gave them the direction, but they were fighting on their own. And so that explains the lack of success in those first two campaigns. And they were taking on Benjamin by the Lord's direction, but not with the Lord's assistance. So this third approach, much better for the nation. Everything is different on this third time. It says that they were sitting before the Lord. That means they're waiting on the Lord. They're seeking the Lord and they're not leaving until they know that things are right between them and the Lord. We read that they were weeping. We read that they were fasting, which is taking weeping and mourning to the next intensity level. As I said last week, anyone can cry about something, But it takes a really determined person, someone really deeply motivated to fast about that same thing that's bothering them. Well, the nation did that. Again, we read they brought their consecration and fellowship offering. So they were serious with the Lord this time. And of course, what did the Lord do? He accepted them. He didn't even give them the lecture. He didn't even give them the cold shoulder for a while until he warmed up to them again. You know this about God, and you appreciate this about God. I know you do. That he is always ready with the ring, the robe, and the fattened calf. He's always ready to celebrate your return to him. That's all he ever wants. He's not going to rub it in. He's not going to cold shoulder you if you return to the Lord. That's all that he wants, and he receives. And that's what he did for the 11 tribes. He received them back, and then the Lord promised those 11 tribes, okay, yep, go out again, go to battle against Benjamin. This time it's different, because this time I'm fighting for you. In fact, the Lord says the battle's going to be over, the war's going to be over by the end of tomorrow. Come the end of the day tomorrow, this is all done. Because the Lord says, I'm going to do this for you. I'm going to fight this battle and win it for you. So that brings us current to verse 29. And let's just keep plugging our way through this story. Verse 29, so Israel, the unified 11 tribes, set men in ambush around Gibeah. So what we're getting now is the story of this final battle, this third battle. And the Lord is giving us in the text here the strategy and then the details behind it. Now, I won't spend much time on the battle specifics and the strategy and all of the details here. But I will be thorough enough to help you completely understand this. It's just that I'm going to be moving through it rather quickly. So this might be something you come to in the future that if you ever need to really understand what all is taking place here in the story, in this battle, you can go back through that teaching slow. Hit pause, write something down. Play it again, hit pause, write something down. Verse 30, and the people of Israel went up against the people of Benjamin on the third day and set themselves in array against Gibeah, as at other times. Verse 31, and the people of Benjamin went out against the people and were drawn away from the city. And as at other times, they began to strike and kill some of the people in the highways, one of which goes up to Bethel and the other to Gibeah and in the open country, about 30 men of Israel, 32. And the people of Benjamin said, they are routed before us as at the first. We are winning again. Yes, we're going to win this battle too. We are very good. But the people of Israel said, let us flee and draw away from the city to the highways. So they got a plan now. You're going to notice. Yes, things are definitely different now that the Lord is involved. And see how easy this is when you involve the Lord? You might not even realize just how involved he is. All he's doing here is directing their thoughts. He's giving them a strategy. And it's the same way in spiritual battles when we're going through spiritual battles with the Lord. When he's involved, he can even help direct the thoughts in our minds. He can help us to formulate the strategies in our thinking that are going to make us successful in our spiritual battles. So the Lord is in this now, and the outcome is going to be very different. Only God knows why those 30 soldiers that we just read about in the previous verse had lost their life. I am not quite sure why that would happen. You know, you look at this story and you say the Lord's involved. Well, did he not get involved until right here when they end up with this strategy? Because just before this, 30 people died. I don't really have a good answer to that question. I guess if I was looking for a way to explain this, I might say that they didn't enact God's plan until after those 30 died. Maybe that was the final push. They're losing guys again. It looks like they're going to lose again. Okay, Lord, help us. Okay, yeah, that's what we can do. But now they got a plan. Verse 33. And all the men of Israel rose up out of their place and set themselves in array at Baal Tamar. And the men of Israel who were in ambush rushed out of their place from Ma'ara Giba. So Israel sprung a trap on them. That's what we just read. They drew the Benjaminites out of the city of Gibeah and brought them right to where they had men hiding out, ready to ambush them, ready to pounce. Verse 34, and there came against Gibeah 10,000 chosen men out of all of Israel. And the battle was hard, but the Benjamites did not know that disaster was close upon them. 35. And the Lord defeated. Who defeated? The Lord defeated, not the 11 tribes. The Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel. And the people of Israel destroyed 25,100 men of Benjamin that day. Now, do you remember how many there were to start with? I said it in the introduction. 26,700, right? So they're down to just 1,600 soldiers at this point. A pretty major wipeout. All these were men who drew the sword. They were all soldiers. Verse 36. So the people of Benjamin saw that they were defeated, and beginning right here, believe it or not, mid-sentence, this is what we English speakers would call a parenthetical insert. And maybe you don't realize it just yet, but you were just given a very concise description of this battle and the trap that was sprung. But now we get a parenthetical insert, essentially. And what the text is going to do now is it's going to go back through the story it just gave us. Only this time it's going to give us all of the details. It's going to show us exactly how all of this happened, exactly how Israel sprung this trap and how many people died in each location and that sort of thing. So it's giving us the finer details. It says the men of Israel gave ground to Benjamin. So yeah, they acted like they were in retreat because they were trying to lure them away from the city of Gibeah. The men of Israel gave ground to Benjamin because they trusted the men in ambush whom they had set against Gibeah. So that is springing the trap. We'd read that. Verse 37, then the men in ambush, and this is actually another set of ambushers, not the main ambushers, as you're going to see in verse 38. These are specific ambushers set up to ambush the city once the Benjaminite soldiers pull away from Gibeah, okay? So they hurried and rushed against Gibeah. The men in ambush moved out and struck all the city with the edge of the sword, verse 38. Now the appointed signal between the men of Israel and the men in the main ambush was that when the assigned ambushers, the ambushers assigned to the city, made a great cloud of smoke rise up out of the city, verse 39, the men of Israel should turn in battle. Now Benjamin had begun to strike and kill about 30 men of Israel. So here's a placeholder to keep us attached to the original story. You remember we read that part where the 30 Israelites died. That was given to us in verse 31. Reading on. They said, surely they are defeated before us as in the first battle. It's another placeholder. We read that in verse 32. Verse 40. But when the signal began to rise out of the city in a column of smoke, the Benjaminites looked behind them, and behold, the whole of the city went up in smoke to heaven. 41. Then the men of Israel turned, and the men of Benjamin were dismayed, for they saw that disaster was close upon them. And there's another placeholder. We read that very statement in verse 34. We're working our way back through that story. Verse 42. Therefore, they turned their backs before the men of Israel in the direction of the wilderness. But the battle overtook them, and those who came out of the cities were destroying them in their midst. So the Benjaminites were now getting attacked from both fronts. They were being attacked by the ambushers that they were being led to away from the city and toward the wilderness, but now the ambushers have destroyed the city and they're leaving the city, and now they're pursuing from the other side of the soldiers, the Benjaminites. So there's the additional details. It looks something like this. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to draw Benjamin away from the city of Gibeah. We're going to send soldiers to kill the whole city once we draw them away. And once they kill everyone in the city, then they're going to set the city on fire. And the smoke signal, that's the signal that's when we're to go ahead and attack the soldiers of Benjamin. So that was the moment of springing the trap. But then you also have, you know, the ambushers from the city attacking Benjamin on that front too. So there's a whole lot of movement there. It's complicated, but really if you just listen to the things I said and then go back through it again real carefully, you'll see what I'm telling you is correct. This would have all been about timing if you just think about this. Because those soldiers that were in the main ambush, they were waiting out in the wilderness away from the city of Gibeah, they were in a location and they were waiting there the whole time. So that needed to be the location of the first attack. In the meantime, you had all of this based on timing as they're faking this retreat. They can't just instantly draw all the way back to where those ambushers are in the wilderness. They have to time this. They have to give the other ambushers set to ambush the city the time to get in there, destroy the whole city, set the whole city on fire, and then be ready to follow up on the attack from the other side. So that's all timing. It's kind of like you have to fight a little bit, act like you're getting whooped, retreat a little bit, fight a little bit more, act like you're getting whooped, retreat a little bit. You get back near that spot in the wilderness. You got to be ready. You got to time it just right. And then there's the smoke signal. Okay, let's do it. Everyone out. And then the attack. And then the counterattack where you have the army of Benjamin surrounded. So the plan had to be good, but the execution of that plan had to be perfectly timed, and it was. They did a great job, and they had thoroughly destroyed the soldiers of Benjamin. Verse 43, surrounding the Benjaminites, they pursued them and trod them down from Nohah as far as opposite Gibeah on the east. 44, 18,000 men of Benjamin fell. So that is, in the ambush, that first ambush attack from the main ambushers, 18,000 were killed. This is breaking down all of the numbers for us. Reading on, all of them men of valor. We're talking about the Benjaminites there. Credit where credit is due. They were courageous soldiers. They were defending wickedness, but they were still courageous soldiers. Nonetheless, this wasn't an easy fight. Verse 45, and they turned and fled toward the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon. So those who were not killed fled the ambush. 5,000 men of them were cut down in the highways. So 18,000 killed during the ambush, 5,000 more men fleeing from the ambush in this particular direction. So that's 23,000 dead here. And they were pursued hard to get them. And 2,000 men of them were struck down, 2,000 fleeing in the other direction. So 23,000 plus 2,000 more, you're now at 25,000. Verse 46. So all who fell that day of Benjamin were 25,000 men who drew the sword, all of them men of valor. So that's giving us the current account, but not a final count. There's more to die yet. Verse 35 gave us a count of 25,100 dead, and we're not even there yet. Verse 47, but 600 men turned and fled toward the wilderness of the rock of Rimmon and remained at the rock of Rimmon 4 months. So 600 Benjamites escaped and went into hiding in the heights. They were hiding out in the caves for 4 months trying to eke out a survival. Verse 48, and the men of Israel turned back against the people of Benjamin and struck them with the edge of the sword, the city, men and beasts, and all that they found, and all the towns that they found they set on fire. So, folks, this is where we would get the rest of our numbers to total 26,100 dead. There's an additional 1,100 people that die, courtesy of verse 48. That final number isn't given to us, but that's what it has to be, because only 600 men have survived this attack. 600 soldiers of Benjamin survived that war. Now, let's infuse our story with some balanced biblical perspective here. A common mistake for a Bible reader is in thinking that whatever it is that they're reading that God is doing, he must want to be doing whatever that is that he's doing. And that is not a good way to read everything that you read in the Bible. When you're reading the Bible and God is doing something, you need to ask yourself a very important question. Is this something that God wants to be doing, or is this something that God has to be doing? You got to know the difference between the two. If you don't know the difference between the two, you'll look at some of the things that the Lord does, and you'll say, boy, Lord, I just don't understand you. One of the first things you told us about yourself is that you are long-suffering, merciful. Your mercy extends to all generations. And now here you are, Lord, just wiping out an entire tribe. Is that really what he wanted to do? No, of course, that's not what he wanted to do. So there are things that we read in the Bible that God wanted to do. There are things that God had to do, and we have to know the difference to get the right interpretation of whatever it is that we're studying. I can tell you some things the Lord wanted to do. He wanted to lead the nation of Israel out of bondage from Egypt. He wanted to bring them to a land flowing with milk and honey. He wanted to give them that land. He wanted to make that people his holy, special, chosen people. Those were some things the Lord wanted to do. Here's something the Lord did not want to do. The Lord did not want to wipe out a whole tribe of Benjamin. Why is he doing this? Well, almost a whole tribe, I should say. But why is he doing this? God is doing this because he has to. He did not want any of this to happen. He didn't want Gibeah to fall to this kind of wickedness. And he certainly didn't want Benjamin to defend that wickedness and then get in God's crosshairs as this battle was taking place. So the fact that this entire tribe of Benjamin falls here, it's not something the Lord wanted to do. God wanted 12 tribes, and he wanted all 12 tribes saved, as we would look at it, right? He wanted them to be his people. He didn't want to have to do this, but God finds the tribe of Benjamin resisting him and fighting for the wrong side, defending wickedness, and it is only because they got involved. It's only because they got involved. Those lessons are transferable to us, pretty much fully intact as they are. Just add quite a bit of mercy to that in your New Testament picture of what these lessons look like for us. And there you have it. God was extending less mercy in these days that we're reading about, because as among other reasons, Hebrews tells us that these things were happening for our examples. So the Lord had to judge sin pretty harshly in those early days so that the example could be set. And he is more merciful to us. But it should not be comforting to us that God is more merciful to us even when we are openly fighting against him. We're openly making ourselves an enemy of God through our actions and through the practices of wickedness. So that's a good lesson for us to learn. Here's the lesson from Gibeah. And I'll make this short and to the point. We cannot engage in practices of wickedness and expect God to not be incited against us. His present long-suffering may stay his hand of judgment. You may live to the end of your life in your wickedness, but I'm not sure that's doing you much good. If you end up that way, you're still an enemy of God. And you'll answer for your wickedness against the Lord, your crimes against God and against all of creation itself. So that's the lesson from Gibeah. And then we have the lesson from Benjamin, which would be when God is at war with wickedness, don't stick your nose in there. Don't get in the way. Get behind God. Let God execute fairness and justice. He's always going to do that. God is perfectly just. He never makes a judgment call that is not absolutely spot on. That's what righteousness means. It means to be right on. It's right onness. Righteousness is right onness. God is righteous. His judgments are always right on. So you let the Lord do what he does in every situation. You trust him, but you keep yourself out of it. When God is at war with wickedness, that is a duel between the two of them. And you shouldn't be involved in that duel. You shouldn't fall and be collateral damage in a war between God and wickedness. So shout out to the philosophy of Rabbi Gamaliel here from Acts chapter 5. And what did his wisdom teach us there in Acts chapter 5? I'll put it in my own words. The philosophy of Gamaliel was essentially this. Don't get yourself into the middle of any situation where you may end up fighting against God. Isn't that what Gamaliel told the Sanhedrin, right? Don't get in any situation where God ends up somehow becoming your opponent, because that is not a battle that you're going to win. Don't get involved in that duel, that shootout. That fight is not your fight. Wickedness is not only costly to those who practice wickedness, it is also costly to those who defend it. Wouldn't you agree? That's what Judges chapter 20 has taught us. So I think of what Paul said in Romans chapter 1 verse 32. He talked about those who practice wickedness and give their approval of it. Romans 1:32, he said, though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. So don't defend the wicked. That's the lesson of Judges chapter 20. Don't approve of the wicked. That we could throw that in as a lesson from Romans 1:32. Don't defend the wicked. Don't approve of the wicked in their actions. So in other words, do not be an accomplice in a crime against God. Do not be an accomplice in a crime against God. Let me put it to you like this. Don't fly a banner to support those who are marching for the right to commit wickedness against God. Is that plain enough? That's more closely related to what Paul was saying there in Romans chapter 1. So, Romans chapter 1. Do not defend the wicked. No, pardon me, Judges chapter 20, do not defend the wicked. Romans chapter 1, verse 32, don't approve of the wicked even. Those are the major lessons of our story here. You know the major lessons of the final four chapters by now. The major lesson is that if we are not doing the things that God has already taught us in His Word to be right in His sight, then by default, we are going to be doing the things that are evil in His sight, even though they may seem perfectly right in our own eyes. God sets the standard of judgment and practice and behavior for all of His creation, and we are subject to it, this entire universe. So that's the lesson, the overarching lesson, which very much factored into the events that we have studied in the last three Old Testament studies. But these are the lessons from this story. Abandon wicked practices. Wiccan practices too, I might add. Abandon wicked and Wiccan practices. And then do not defend those who do them. Your culpability is right up there with them if you're defending them in their wickedness. Do not defend or celebrate wickedness. And now we take a look at chapter 21. It won't take too long. It is the fallout of the chapter 20 war of the 11 unified tribes against the solo tribe of Benjamin. Chapter 21. Now the men of Israel had sworn at Mizpah, no one of us shall give his daughter in marriage to Benjamin. So this was something we did not read about until now. This was obviously decided in chapter 20, verse 1. Look at that verse. They decided in that meeting at Mizpah, as they were trying to figure this all out and get a game plan against Gibeah, they had decided there that once they got to the bottom of this, and whoever it was that was guilty of this, here's what they were going to do. They were going to wipe out that entire family, that entire clan, and they were going to make sure that that clan could not procreate. So they were going to They made this vow, they took this oath before the Lord, not a one of us tribes that are here at this meeting at Mizpah, not a one of us are going to let them have wives from our tribes. That was an oath that they took. Verse 2, And the people came to Bethel and sat there till evening before God. And they lifted up their voices and wept bitterly. Verse 3. And they said, O Lord, the God of Israel, why has this happened in Israel that today there should be one tribe lacking in Israel? Well, I'll tell you why this happened in Israel. It's because Israel destroyed that whole tribe nearly. That's why it's happening. They did it. They destroyed them. Why are they asking the Lord? Lord, why did this happen? Maybe you do that in your life, like you cause a mess of your life, and then you say, Lord, why did this happen? How could this happen? Sometimes I wish the Lord would just break the silence and be honest with us and say, well, you did this to yourself, you big dummy, but I still love you, and I'm going to help you through it. And that's kind of the situation here. They did this to themselves. They wiped out that tribe nearly, almost into extinction, but now they're regretting it. They feel bad. Boo-hoo, there's supposed to be 12 tribes, and we're 11 tribes now. What are we going to do? Verse 4, and the next day the people rose early and built there an altar and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. Now, this one is really confusing to me. I don't know why you build a new altar there in Bethel when the official altar from the official tabernacle is right there in that same city, and you've already been using it. You've already been going there to inquire of the Lord. You've already been going there to do the burnt offerings and the fellowship offerings, the peace offerings. Why build another altar and go outside of the tabernacle? It doesn't seem to me that the Lord had called for this. And I think maybe it's pretty fitting for what's about to happen. They're just kind of doing their own thing here. I know they're praying to the Lord, but the solution they come up with, I can assure you, is not something that the Lord gave them. So I see this as very symbolic. They're building their own altar when the real one is right there. They're building their own altar and they're formulating their own plan on how to save that 12th tribe so that they don't end up as 11 tribes. And the next day, verse 4, the people rose early and built there an altar and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. Verse 5, and the people of Israel said, which of all the tribes of Israel did not come up in the assembly of the Lord? I really like this. They're like, was there any tribal family that wasn't present for that meeting in Mizpah? And we were all angry at receiving those 12 pieces of the concubine, and we were trying to figure that whole situation out, and we had that big meeting. Who didn't show up? Let's take a look at the records. Let's find out who didn't show up. Why might they be asking that question? They're asking that question because they're looking for a loophole to save the tribe of Benjamin. Verse 5, for they had taken a great oath concerning him who did not come up to the Lord to Mizpah, saying, he shall surely put to death. So there's yet another oath that they took right at chapter 20, verse 1, that we didn't know about until now. They took this oath there at Mizpah, and they said, anyone that doesn't show up for this meeting, we're going to kill them all. Aren't you glad we aren't that strict with attendance here at Anchored Fellowship? Maybe we should be. You know what? I'm going to pray about that. I mean, it's biblical, so I better pray about it. Verse 6, and the people of Israel had compassion for Benjamin, their brother, that is, their brother tribe, and said, one tribe is cut off from Israel this day. Verse 7, what shall we do for wives for those who are left, since we have sworn by the Lord that we will not give them any of our daughters for wives? So you see where this is headed yet? Verse 8, and they said, what one is there of the tribes of Israel that did not come up to the Lord to Mizpah? And behold, no one had come to the camp from Jabesh-Gilead to the assembly. Uh-oh. Okay, now do you see what's happening? They have two oaths going on. The first oath is, we're going to wipe out any tribe that didn't show up for our Mizpah meeting. Oath number two, we will not give wives to whoever it is that we destroy in cleaning up this mess from Gibeah. But now they want to give wives to the people of Benjamin. Where are they going to get those wives? Well, maybe from a tribe that they're about ready to destroy for not showing up for the meeting. Verse 9. For when the people were mustered, I promise no ketchup jokes this week. For when the people were mustered, behold, not one of the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead was there. Verse 10. So the congregation sent 12,000 of their bravest men there and commanded them, go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead with the edge of the sword, also the women and the little ones. Verse 11. This is what you shall do. Every male and every woman that has lain with the male, you shall devote to destruction. Okay, now you know where this is going. Verse 12. And they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man by lying with him. And they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. So they're obviously going to use this smaller clan as the loophole to solve their problem. They figure they'll be honoring two oaths in one. They'll be killing two oaths with one stone, two birds with one stone. They swore death to Jabesh-Gilead, and they swore not to give Benjamin wives. But Jabesh-Gilead wasn't there. Here's the catch. Jabesh-Gilead wasn't there for the Mizpah meeting. That tribe did not promise that they would not give wives to the people of Gibeah or Benjamin, as the case may be. So they could take those virgins from that tribe, kill the whole tribe, and they've solved all of their problems. Right? Except for, I think everyone would agree, except for Jabesh-Gilead. Verse 13, then the whole congregation sent word to the people of Benjamin who were at the rock of Rimmon and proclaimed peace to them. Verse 14, and Benjamin returned at that time, and they gave them the women whom they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh-Gilead, but they were not enough for them. Did you catch that? How many men do they need to get wives for? 600. They found 400 virgins. So they're like, oh man, we ran out of virgins. We need more virgins. I say, no, you don't. You found 400 wives for 400 of the 600 guys. I don't think the other 200 need to have wives. 400 families, that's definitely enough to repopulate the tribe of Benjamin. After all, these are folks you just whooped in war. They were trying to kill you a short while ago. I think you make the other 200 go without their wives. But nope. They say, man, now we got to find 200 more virgins, but we got to do it in a way where we don't break our oath. So, verse 15, the people had compassion on Benjamin because the Lord had made a breach in the tribes of Israel. I don't know how I feel about that statement. How do you feel about that statement? I don't really feel like this should be pinned on the Lord. I feel like they're blaming it on the Lord, but I don't really think this is something the Lord did. He certainly didn't want this. Benjamin caused this by defending wickedness. So that's not really the Lord's fault. But then I guess the Lord was forced to act and play this out the way that it did. So I don't know. But personally, I like keeping the blame on Benjamin here. Verse 16, then the elders of the congregation said, what shall we do for wives for those who are left, since the women are destroyed out of Benjamin? 17, and they said, there must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe not be blotted out from Israel. Verse 18, yet we cannot give them wives from our daughters, for the people of Israel had sworn, Judges chapter 20, verse 1, cursed be he who gives a wife to Benjamin. And it's not written here, but I right about here, I can just about assure you that someone heard that statement. Here's the oath. Cursed be he who gives a wife to Benjamin. That's it. That's the key. The word give. We can't give wives to Benjamin. See, this is the problem with some of our oaths. We take these oaths and then we don't want to do them. And the Lord is bummed out already about you not wanting to do them. And there you are trying to find ways around your own words. This is terrible. We said give. If we can pull this off without giving them, quote unquote, giving them the wives, then, well, we can do this without violating our own oath. So, how do we do this? Verse 19. Wait, where are we? Verse 18, 19. So, they said, behold, there is the yearly feast of the Lord at Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Labona. Verse 20. And they commanded the people of Benjamin, saying, go and lie in ambush in the vineyards, verse 21, and watch. If the daughters of Shiloh come out to dance in the dances, then come out of the vineyards and snatch each man his wife. Catch yourself a virgin. And there you go. You got yourself a wife. Catch a virgin from the daughters of Shiloh and go to the land of Benjamin. So there you have it. All of the other tribes were in good standing. They couldn't give wives to the people of Benjamin, but they were just set on this, getting all of those 600 guys wives. So they know this, that every year when the daughters of Shiloh come out to dance, they're all virgins. I don't know, some kind of special part of the dance where virgin gals came out. Maybe it was for mixing and matching and finding mates, all of that sort of thing. Who knows? But they knew those gals were all going to be virgins, so all they had to do was just attack the dancers, grab yourself a wife, run off with her, and then everyone's happy. Makes total sense, doesn't it? Good idea. Is any of this a good idea? No. What's going on here? Here's what's going on here. There was no king in Israel, and everyone was doing what was right in their own sight. Verse 22. And when their fathers or their brothers come to complain to us, we will say to them, grant them graciously to us, because we did not take for each man of them his wife in battle. Neither did you give them to them, else you would now be guilty. He's saying, hey, there's a difference between giving and taking. We didn't give them. They took them. So you should feel really good about this. This is like the moral high ground. We saved your tribe from violating the oath. All you gotta do is shut your mouth right now. Let the kidnapping of the virgins be. Let it be as it is, and we've solved the problem. Well, no, you didn't. Two wrongs never make a right. Neither do three wrongs in this case. I mean, I appreciate how seriously they take oaths, but come on, sinning against others in order to keep your oaths, that does not solve all of your problems. It makes some. They would have been best to just dump both of these oaths, because bigger picture, did the Lord want either of these oaths? Of course not. He doesn't want them wiping out anyone that doesn't show up for a meeting. So there you go. I'm not going to pray about that here at Anchored Fellowship. I know the truth. No, we can't wipe people out just for not showing up for meetings. And no, we there's no need to do that. Refrain from giving wives to the people of Benjamin. If you want the tribe to survive, and I'm sure the Lord did, my goodness, give them wives, break the oaths. But no, they'd rather wipe out a tribe and have virgins stolen from the dances there at Shiloh in order to save themselves from feeling like they had broken their oaths. Both of those oaths were made out of anger. That's why you keep your big trap shut when you're angry, because you never know what you're going to swear to. I swear I'm never going to let this drop. I give my word, I will be avenged. Arlen will be avenged. Yeah, shut up. Just keep your mouth shut when you're angry. Verse 23. And the people of Benjamin did so and took their wives. They snatched themselves up, some virgins, right from the dances, according to their number, from the dancers whom they carried off. So I guess if we're looking at the positive here, they not only got their wives, those 200, but they got wives that could dance. I wonder if the other 400 Benjamites are a little jealous. Hey, we didn't get dancing wives. Why didn't we get dancing wives? How come they got dancing wives? I don't know. Then they went and returned to their inheritance with their dancing wives that they stole, and rebuilt the towns and lived in them. Verse 24, and the people of Israel departed from there at that time every man to his tribe and family, and they went out from there, every man to his inheritance. Verse 25, here it is. I love it. In case you were like trying to figure out, is this story, like, is this all supposed to be happening? I love it. Here's the capstone. Here's the statement that begins this section, the statement that we're hitting up against in chapter 18 and 19, and then the statement that ends this chapter that really explains why all of the insanity in these four chapters is happening. Here it is. In those days, there was no king in Israel. And when the king is away, the servants will play. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. All right, are you ready for it? The official statement. Thus concludes our chapter by chapter, verse by verse study through the book of Judges. Let's give the Lord a hand clap offering.